This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today is Utah State University's Extension Fruit Specialist, Brent Black. And we have a lot to talk about. It is a pre-taped program, so we won't be able to take your calls, but you can still send in questions to be answered later via our Facebook page at Utah Public Radio, or send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so it was an interesting winter again. It doesn't seem like we ever have a consistent winter ever. And it was, I won't say warm, but it never got really cold. And then we had 2 weeks in December where it got really cold and there was no snow. So how is that affecting our fruit crops?
So we're seeing more bud damage than we've seen in the past. We've had in the past, we've had problems with, 2010 is a good example. If you go back to 2010, we had kind of a similar situation. We had a very mild fall where it never got really below freezing up until the week of Thanksgiving. And then you remember that cold front came through and it got very, very cold quite rapidly. And so that resulted in a lot more damage than what we would normally expect. So that week in 2010, it got down to maybe 0 degrees. And normally that wouldn't be cold enough to cause damage, but because the trees hadn't had cold before that to kind of acclimate, they were much more sensitive and we saw a lot of damage. We don't know how extensive the damage is going to be this year, but we do know in going out and looking at some orchards that there's a lot less flower buds that survived that than what would normally be on the tree. So if you go out and look, and we'll talk about peaches, but you can, and there's resources online where you can look at what buds look like on different types of fruit trees. And in the case of a peach, since we're going to use that example, there are flower buds and there are leaf buds, and the two are very distinct. The leaf buds tend to be kind of shaped like a rocket. They're very pointed and narrow, and the flower buds tend to be kind of round. And if you look at the node, at the spot where the leaf was last year, there can be up to three buds at each node. There'll be
three flowering buds?
Three buds total. So the middle one will be a flower bud, and then the two on either side will be the little round, the middle one will be vegetative, or leaf and shoot bud, and the ones on the outside will be the round flower buds. And that every node isn't going to have three buds, but it can have up to three. And what we're seeing this year, because of that cold snap that we had in December, a lot of those flower buds have dried up and fallen off the tree. And so if you look now, instead of you're looking at a nice fruiting lateral, the shoot that's maybe pencil sized that's coming off the main branch, normally we'd see 20 or 30 flowers on that branch. And in some of the orchards I visited, there's maybe two or three flower buds left. The rest have frozen. And it's not consistent all over the state, but I've seen it in pockets all over the state. So the recommendation that we're giving is that growers go out and look at the flower buds and get a handle for what's really there before they start pruning. Because if they prune to the same degree that they normally would, they're not going to have as many flower buds as they had hoped for. And without sufficient fruit crop on that tree, you're going to get this explosion of vegetative growth that you're going to have to deal with in the future.
So it sounds like the flowering buds are more susceptible to the colder temperatures.
Always.
The vegetative buds are not.
Yes, always. That's always the case. So normally, even in the fall, they tend to have a little bit more water content in the bud. So when it gets down below freezing, that water freezes and disrupts the cells in the bud. So they tend to be more susceptible in the fall as well as in the spring. Now, if we had, I've got colleagues in the East that are talking about the polar vortex that we had in January, and they're not nearly as worried about it because that came after some cold and the trees were about as acclimated as they could be. So -5 or -10 isn't going to do much damage if the tree was prepared for it, which is the case for them. But for us this year, that early December freeze, I think, is what caused the damage. So the warning is just get out, look around, see what what the bud numbers look like before you start pruning.
And is this mostly for stone fruits like the apricots and peaches?
So, yes, mostly. Cherries, same way. Apples tend to be, and pears tend to be more hardy. One way you can look at those is if you get a razor blade and just kind of slice open some buds, if they're nice and yellow or white or green through the middle, they're healthy. But a lot of times if there's damage and you slice through the middle of that bud, you'll see some blackened tissue. And it looks very minute relative to the rest of the bud, but that's usually the flower part. So when apples, you have a mixed bud. So there's leaves and then there's also flowers in the middle of that bud. And so if you slice through and see some small areas in the middle that are black, it's curtains for that.
So is that why they're less susceptible? Because the flowery part is in the middle of the vegetative matter?
Not so much. It's just they're just more hardy. They don't have the water content and so forth.
So how long does a tree take to become acclimated?
So acclimation takes place basically in two steps. The first step is triggered by short days. So as the days get short in the fall, then you get some level of acclimation. And usually that takes it down so that it can tolerate maybe 7 or 8 or maybe 10 degrees below freezing. And then it will drop to that level. And then the next stage of acclimation happens when it's exposed to cold temperatures. And so what you really like to have is you like to have short days to get the process started, and then you'd like to have a few nights of 25 degrees or in that range to kind of get things going before the really cold temperature comes. The other thing that's a little bit of a concern too is that when you get warm temperatures in the middle of the winter, if it stays warm for a period of time, you lose some of that hardiness and things tend to deacclimate. They lose their ability to withstand it. So if you had really warm conditions in early February, like we sometimes do, and then get very cold temperatures very suddenly, you can get some of the same types of damage. So it's really a little bit at a time is good. And one of the concerns that the climate scientists are telling us is that these extremes where we have warm conditions and then sudden drops in temperature are going to be more likely to happen in the future. And if that's the case, we're going to really struggle with this kind of damage more often than we have.
So as I've understood it, apples are just there's so many cold hours that fruit trees need in order to set their fruit and then to survive through the winter. And stone fruits like peaches and apricots need fewer of those cold hours than apples. And so when we have those warm January thaw, for instance, they've already reached the number of cold hours, and so they start to come out,
so,
where apples don't? I mean, help explain
that to me.
So
you're talking about what's called a chilling requirement, and what the plants need to fulfill their chilling requirement is actually temperatures close to freezing but not below freezing for a period of time. And different varieties require different amounts of chill hours. And so if they've gotten their chilling requirement and then we get a warm spell, they start to deharden very rapidly. The buds start to swell. So there's two issues. One is if they've fulfilled their chilling requirement, you get warm temperatures, not only do they deacclimate and lose some of their hardiness, you also start to get bud swell, which can be disastrous. But even if they haven't got their chilling requirement fulfilled, if we get a warm stretch in the middle of the winter, they'll still lose some of that hardiness. And it's not that the chilling requirement isn't so much difference between, say, peaches and cherries and apples, but different varieties actually have different chill requirements. So if I'm going to grow peaches in Georgia or South Carolina, I don't get as many chill hours as if I'm in Michigan or Utah or somewhere colder. And so I'm going to select varieties that don't need a lot of chilling, because then they'll wake up and grow when they're supposed to. Whereas if I'm in a colder climate that gets these temperature fluctuations, I want to make sure that I have something with a little more chilling hours so that it doesn't try and grow in February.
This is a little off topic, but still related to peach trees. So you're talking about Georgia peaches,
mm-hmm,
and Utah peaches.
Mm-hmm.
which ones taste better? Because I would think that the coolness might concentrate the sugars, but maybe that's more of a product of the growing season and toward the end of the growing season when they're ready to come off.
So that's a good question, and there's a physiological answer, and then there's everybody's opinion. So what happens is plants respire, so that they photosynthesize to get carbon out of the atmosphere and form sugars, and they also respire. They burn it to fuel energy for growth and so forth. And what happens in climates like Utah is the respiration rate, the rate at which they're burning up their carbon, their carbohydrates, is a function of temperature. And so, and they don't regulate their temperature like you and I do, obviously. And so if we have warm, sunny days where photosynthesis is as fast as it can go, it's really at peak, so that that plant is accumulating carbohydrates. Then if it's warm at night, a lot of that carbon is respired away and it goes back out as CO2 again. Whereas if we have cold nights, then it's not respired away, so the plant has all this available carbon that they need to store, and it goes into fruit and into storage tissues. So having warm, sunny days, bright, sunny days, and warm conditions for optimum photosynthesis, and then cold nights gets the fruit as sweet as it can possibly be. And that's why sometimes there's a wives' tale out there that says the fruit's going to taste better after it's been frozen. Well, not so much. It's just when we start getting cold nights, that's when the cooler nights, that's when the sugar concentration in the fruit goes up.
So am I hearing that Utah peaches taste better than Georgia peaches?
In my opinion, of course. Actually, you know, growers from the high elevation growing areas like Utah and Colorado and Idaho, they get a premium for their fruit because
of the flavor.
Cool. Yeah, we get cool nights during the middle of the summer, so the sugar content of our fruit gets higher. That's why tart cherries from Utah have higher sugar content as a rule than tart cherries from Michigan, because they're ripened in the middle of the summer when it's hot 24 hours a day in Michigan, but we still have cool nights for better sugar accumulation.
So Cache Valley could be a great area, except the farmers have to put up with those temperature fluctuations. Can, I mean, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years in a row, you might not get any fruit production. So
yeah, so that it's kind of a blessing and a curse. If we can have those cool nights without having late spring frosts or being able to protect from those, then we get the best of both worlds.
Okay, so let's go back to talking about this, the cold damage that may or may not have happened. What areas of the state are you hearing reports back?
We've seen damage in as far south as Washington County. Obviously, they had some very cold temperatures down there that damaged a lot of the trees that normally aren't damaged down there. So we've seen a lot of damage there. We've seen it in areas in Utah County and other areas where it didn't hit nearly so bad, just from one orchard to the other, there's variation. I've seen it in Cache Valley as well. Those are the areas that I've looked at. So pretty much all over the state, there's the potential, and it really depends on your microclimate. And we've talked in the past a little bit about microclimate, that if you look at a hardiness zone map of Utah, it looks like somebody spilled their paint colors on it, because you can have three hardiness zones in the same zip code, and that's really different than some parts of the state. So it really depends on that microclimate, where you are in the valley, what the conditions were when that December freeze came along.
So what do you do if you go out and now is a great time to prune? I've been telling people in Hyde Park where I live, they asked me, so should I prune right now? I said, yes, go out. You can see the scaffolding of the tree. It's easier to see what you're pruning. It's not going to damage the tree.
Right.
What do they look? They're looking for those fruiting buds, and I'm so going to prune different?
One of the things that we typically do when we prune peaches and cherries is we'll prune kind of the basic structure. I mean, I look at pruning as a multi-step process. Number one, you're going to look at the tree and look for problems. You're going to take out problems, first of all. If you've got diseased or damaged branches, if you've got branches that are rubbing, if you've got really narrow crotch angles that are going to develop into weak scaffolds that can't support a load, you're going to take care of those first, obviously. You've got to get rid of the problems. And then you're going to be kind of opening up the tree to get good light penetration. And that's true of all the different temperate fruit trees that we grow. But then oftentimes you're going to prune even a little bit more to reduce the potential crop load so that you don't have to thin so much. So in the case of peaches, you've got these pencil-sized fruiting laterals, shoots that are maybe 12 inches long. That's going to be your best bet for producing nice fruit. And we might prune more of those off just so that we don't have to thin so much later on. And same with cherries. You get your fruiting wood on the second year old wood and down, and we might cut in and take some of that out to reduce the crop load so that the tree's not bearing so much fruit in one season. Well, this year we're going to see a lot less fruit on that fruiting wood. So the recommendation would be to leave more of it behind, because if you don't have enough fruit on the tree, the energy's got to go somewhere, and it's going to grow into water sprouts and these really vigorous upright shoots that you're going to just have to take out anyway. So you're fighting the vigor of the tree. If you can leave more of those fruiting laterals on, then you hopefully will still get the kind of crop load that you want so that that tree doesn't explode into too much growth.
So basically less pruning this year.
So less, you're still going to want to avoid, you're still going to want to go out and take out problems. If you've got water sprouts that are straight up and down and you don't want them, there's no sense leaving them. But if you're going to leave more fruiting wood on there than you normally would.
And generally the pruning that you do on a peach or an apricot, you prune those heavier than you would do an apple or a pear.
Right.
Because that promotes that growth.
That first year wood that gives you the fruit that you want.
Okay. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and I'm your host, Brian Earle. And with me today is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we're talking about the upcoming fruit season. And if you'd like to send us a question or comment, this is a pre-taped program, but you can send your comments via our UPR Facebook page or send them to zestygarden@gmail.com. So pruning-wise, you've talked about what to look for with the stone fruits and what to look forward to see if there's any damage in the apples and the pears. As you've cleaned out your crossing branches or branches that are dead, what's really going to be your next step? Because I go in and I've got a lot of apples, and I don't want to thin out too many apples right away. But when you see those fruiting spurs, do you just generally do the ones that are on the side and take off the ones that are on the top and the bottom? What's the good rule of thumb?
So, there's besides taking out the problems, you've got to look at branch density. So a good rule of thumb that I like to think of is if you can stand back and look and see where somebody could kick a soccer ball through the middle of that tree without hitting a branch, then you've got good light penetration. And if what happens is if you don't thin the branches enough to get light all the way to the middle of the tree, then you've got problems going forward, because if there's not enough light getting to the middle of the tree, then there's not going to be any flowers that are there aren't going to produce fruit that you'd actually want to eat. Most of the energy for the development of a fruit comes from the leaves that are on that spur or within just a few inches on the branch. So
very
it's
not
close.
So much that the apples themselves need to have the sunlight. It's just you need to get sunlight into the leaves producing.
The leaves that are right immediately adjacent to that apple are what makes the apple grow.
Okay.
So if you don't get light directly on the fruit, it may still develop the sugars. It may not develop the color that you want. It may be kind of green or yellow at harvest instead of developing the red blush that you want. But if you don't get enough light there, the fruit's not going to color, but it's not also not going to develop the sugar content. So any fruit that develops in that dark shade in the middle of the tree is worthless. But that's only half the problem.
So there's just not going to be any flavor to
right.
those developing
that's
inside.
That's the minor half of the problem. The major half of the problem is if you're not getting light down there, then the spurs die out. They don't produce flowers and fruit for the next year. There's no growth. And oftentimes you'll see when someone hasn't pruned enough, the middle part of the tree is just basically barren. There's branches with no side shoots, no leaves, no fruit, no flowers. They're just what we call blind wood. There's just wood there that's not doing the tree any good.
The fruiting's only happening out on the tips.
Yeah, and if you don't open the tree, that blind wood expands and out and out and out until you've just got this kind of a crust of flowers and leaves and fruit on the outside of that canopy, and all the middle is basically barren. And so you've got to open that up so that you continue to have leaves and flowers and fruit down throughout the tree and use all that space instead of just the outer edge of it.
And there's some great publications at the Extension site. They are available through a link at the Zesty Garden page. They'll take you right to it. You can see exactly what you're looking for and how to prune. And then the local Extension offices are also a great resource for doing that as well. And can you tell me, are there any pruning workshops coming
up? So I know there are some coming up on the Wasatch Front. I don't know the dates. You'll want to contact your local county extension office, and they'll have the dates and locations for those.
And in a gardening calendar that I'll do a little bit later in the program, we'll have some of that information available so that people know when to look. Because having been to a workshop after I've already done some pruning before, it's a real eye-opener to go, oh, wow, I shouldn't have been doing that this whole time.
Right.
And they're really helpful as far as being able to increase your fruit production. And so I highly recommend
it. So I tell people that when you're pruning a fruit tree, it's not like pruning a shade tree. There's two different purposes, and you've got to prune accordingly. And so understanding those differences is going to be really helpful to get production off from your home orchard.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more fruit talk. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in about a minute. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In with me for the rest of the hour is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. So I wanted to make sure that I talked about the pruning of grapes and of raspberries, and also fertilization and all the things that need to go along with that.
So there's raspberries fall into two categories, what they call summer bearers and fall bearers or ever bearers. What you were talking about first is the fall bearing or ever bearing type. And so what they're doing is they're producing a fall crop on the shoot tip of the cane that grew this year. So it'll start growing in spring, it'll come up from the ground, it'll grow, and then in the fall, usually September time frame, the tip of that new shoot will start to produce flowers and fruit, and then usually, depending on how long our fall is and how mild our fall conditions are, it'll continue to flower and fruit until it freezes. And usually that will consume the buds on about the top third of that cane. And then if you leave that cane, the rest of it will produce flowers and fruit the next summer. And that's that. So the first year cane is called a primo cane or primary cane. And the second year cane is called a flora cane or floral cane, meaning it has flowers. So in the fall bears, it'll produce fruit on both the top half or top third of the cane in the fall, the rest of the cane the following summer. There's varieties that grow really well, at least in Cache Valley and warmer, that do really well as fall bearing types. The summer bearing types are the ones that only produce flowers and fruit on second year canes. And so they're the ones that produce a single crop a year. So if you mow those to the ground, you'll never get a crop because they have to go through the winter and then produce fruit on the second year canes.
So if you decide to leave in your everbears and get two crops, and then also, of course, this with the summer bears, how much of the top should you be pruning back? Should you be pruning any of it back?
So what you do when you're pruning a summer-bearing raspberry or an ever-bearing raspberry that you're trying to get two crops off from, the first thing you do is you take out all the canes that fruited all the way to the ground last year, the ones that are
And you can tell because they're dead.
You can tell because they're dead and they have little dried-up clusters where the flowers were and the fruit were. So you're going to prune all those out, first of all, because once they've gone through that two-year cycle and they're in their third year, they're just basically firewood. So you can prune those out. And then the other thing to do is usually we want to thin down the canes so that they're not as dense in the row. And usually a rule of thumb is to have between 4 and 6 canes per foot of row. And so you can do that partly by narrowing the row with a rototiller, just going through and not tilling really deep because we don't want to be busting up roots, but just maybe set the tiller a few inches deep and chopping out those canes on the edges. Narrow your row up a little bit and then go through and thin out the weakest, and maybe sometimes the very first ones, the very biggest ones, will sometimes be a little less winter hardy. And so sometimes you can actually, it's almost like you want the medium-sized canes in some
almost
varieties.
Almost counterintuitive. You think larger the cane, the more fruit I'm going to get, but that's not
necessarily sometimes,
the case.
Yeah, it can be, except for in our climate, sometimes those, what they call bull canes, the really big canes, are actually less cold hardy, and so you'll get more winter damage on those sometimes, and it depends on the variety. But so you're going to narrow it, you're going to thin it down to 4 or 5 canes per foot. Now, if it was a primacane that you're carrying over, you can see where it quit fruiting. As you look down that cane, you'll see the dried up flower clusters down, and then below that point, you'll see the axillary buds. The buds were at the base of where each leaf was last year.
So that's where you prune?
And you just prune off down to where that first bud is that hasn't opened yet, and the rest of that cane is going to produce fruit. Now, in the case of strictly summer bearers, do you head it back or do you leave it unheaded? The answer to that question goes back to thinning. And if you don't cut any of that cane off, you'll get more berries, but a lot of the berries out towards the end aren't very big. And if you head that cane back, you focus that energy into fewer flowering clusters and you actually get a little bit bigger fruit size. So it's a matter of personal preference. If you want total amount of fruit and you're going to make jam out of it and you've got the patience to pick it all, you really don't need to head that cane back at all. If you want big berries so that you can fill up a pint a lot faster, you might head it back. And some, I've seen commercial growers head them anywhere from 3 feet high to 5 feet high, depending on how much vigor they have and how much they're shooting for a bigger fruit size.
Now, did the winter that we just got through that caused the problems with the stone fruits, especially, are you going to see any problems with brambles?
Probably, and my guess, I haven't been out cutting the raspberry and blackberry buds. My guess is that we'll have a bigger problem with blackberries than we do with raspberries.
Don't tell me. I didn't get any blackberries last year, so.
So after, and this is a lot based on what we saw in 2010. When we went around, we saw some cane dieback in the raspberries, but we still got some crop. So you'd lose some of the buds, but there were enough buds there to produce a crop. Whereas what we saw in the blackberries then was a lot of cane dieback. And one of the challenges is, and one of the reasons I haven't bothered to go out and cut a lot of buds is because cold damage in the cane berries, raspberries and blackberries, expresses a little different. And the buds may be just perfectly healthy, but it's the vascular tissue that supplies those buds that gets damaged. And sometimes what you'll see is the bud will break, it'll leaf out, and then it'll kind of yellow and kind of wilt and die.
So how do I tell? Like, I've got blackberries. I want to go in and prune those pretty well. How do I tell which of these canes are ones that I need to keep and the other ones I'm going to take out?
So with blackberries, you're going to prune out everything that fruited last year. So the old flora canes need to come out as well. As far as the primacanes, I don't think that I would do a lot of thinning of those right now.
I've got some boysenberries. I'm tired of babying them along and hardly getting anything off of them. So out they come and I'm going to put something else
in. So one thing, I don't know if you've tried this yet. We didn't talk about boysenberries, but boysenberries are a trailing blackberry raspberry hybrid, and they're
covered with thorns.
Yeah,
oh,
they're nasty. The fruit's good, but it's also
wear
gloves. Get a little bloody getting to
it.
One thing that you can try with boysenberries and any of the trailing types is lay the canes on the ground in the winter and throw straw over the top of them during the worst part.
Oh, I haven't
of winter.
Done the straw. I have laid them on the ground, and they're on the south side of my barn. But
which is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's,
so the
they
problem
come out
with
earlier.
The problem with the south side is it's going to push them to grow earlier. But the south
side, I don't
side,
get the snow cover as much.
Right. And then the other problem is the south side, when the sun goes down, the south side of your barn's just as cold as the north side of your barn. So by having them there where they're getting warmed up during the day and then cold at night, it's probably making things worse for them. You'd actually be better off having them, say, on the east side of your barn where they're going to stay cool through the winter. And then when they wake up, they'll also get less sunburn on them because it's not as hot there.
It's also the place I go to look if all of a sudden our egg production goes down with our chickens. Usually I'll find a humongous hoard of eggs because they go back in behind.
Under the blackberries.
Yeah.
Keeps exactly. the predators out like you.
Yeah. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black, USU Extension Fruit Specialist, is my guest. We have just a couple of minutes left in the program, and I wanted to make sure we talked about fertilization for raspberries. Unless you live in Mendon, where I used to live, I never had to apply iron mm-hmm. or a few other select areas of the valley. You've got to put iron on.
Yeah.
And when's the best time to do that, and how much do you apply?
So we usually put some on just before bud break, get some on the soil, water it in, and then we'll usually put another application on later on. And the thing you need to do is you need to use chelated iron. Not just an iron-containing fertilizer, because if it's not chelated, it's not going to do any good in our soils.
Are there certain brands that you look for? I mean, not one's not necessarily better than another, but some seem to be carried more often.
So the soil scientists tell me for our conditions, the chelating agent that we need is EDDHA. That's the code name or the chemical abbreviation for the type of chelate.
EDDHA. And is it a certain color? I mean, because some of my yellow, some of them are orange.
So there's different brands that carry this EDDHA, and some of them like will have a 138 in the name, like sequestrine 138. There's other brands, but if it has that active ingredient and that's the chelating agent, it will maintain its availability in the soil. And the rates, you'll have to look on the label. It's usually just a few tablespoons for a raspberry patch. And so you're going to mix it up usually in water and drench it on the soil. And one of the things that we've seen, it's happened several times over the last 5 or 6 years, if we have a rainy, wet spring where that soil stays wet for a long period of time and it stays cool, the problem is a lot worse. And so you may have to make several applications to remedy the situation. So cool, wet, where the soil is cold, the iron is less available, so you need to apply it more. Whereas in a more typical year where it warms up and the soil warms up, then it's less of a problem. And that also plays into your management. I know in your situation, you've told me you've got a heavy soil, which is part of the problem. But the other issue there is, be careful not to start irrigating too early, because if you've got a heavier soil and the top inch or two of soil is looking dry, you think, oh boy, I better get some water. Those raspberries are starting to grow. I better do something. And if you put water on, it's going to delay that soil warming up, and it's going to delay the iron availability even later into the season, and you're going to have a bigger problem.
I love to use it looks like a big salt shaker. It's what mm-hmm. some people would use to put cinnamon and sugar together to pour it out. And that's what I use to go up and down the row with, because mm-hmm. it seems to spread it a little bit evenly, and I'm not putting a whole ton in one area.
Right.
And then usually there's enough moisture in the spring to water that in. But if you do wait and put it on when there's vegetative matter, is it how important it is to make sure that that doesn't stay on the leaves?
So I don't think it's going to hurt anything on the
it
leaves.
Won't
In
burn
fact,
the leaves.
You can actually mix up chelates and spray it on the leaf as a foliar feed. It tends to be a little less effective than if you water it in. So if you're going to sprinkle it on the surface, you might just get a rake and disturb
the
scratch it in a little bit and get it down in so that it's
invite my chickens into the raspberries.
Yeah, yeah, and get it in good contact with the soil so it can start to be released and then move down into where it can do some good. But the other approach, which some of the commercial growers will use, is they'll just mix it up in a drench and drench the plants with it.
Mm. Do I need to worry about putting too much on, or can you put too much on?
So
I mean, it's pretty expensive stuff anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
if,
like $50 a container.
So that should limit your putting too much on. So I don't think that it's going to cause toxicity, but it's very expensive. So you want to put it on at the rate, you know.
Just follow the directions.
Yeah, follow the directions. Good is good, and more is not necessarily better.
What about to any other kind of nutrients, nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus? What are raspberry
requirements? So, as far as nitrogen, I usually the recommendation is to look at what kind of growth you're getting. If the plants aren't vigorous enough, you might want to put a little more nitrogen on. Phosphorus and potassium, a little bit of that every year is not a bad thing. But the one thing to remember is that raspberries are a perennial plant, so they can store nutrients over multiple years, which means that they're going to need a lot less applied every year than, say, your vegetable garden. Usually, as a rule of thumb, it's about half to a third as much of P and K, phosphorus and potassium, as what you'd be putting in your tomato patch or your corn patch or so forth.
I thought maybe about using some slow-release fertilizer, maybe that you would put on your lawn that has potassium and phosphorus in it, but would feed it throughout the summer, where a lawn would require about once every couple of months doing that again. I just do it once with the raspberries.
Will that work? And it depends on the release rate of the fertilizer. And if you were going to get a time release type of a encapsulated fertilizer and put it on first thing in the spring, I'd say that's a great idea. Putting it on later in the year is a bad idea. Typically, we don't recommend any fertilizer after mid-July.
Because you want to promote fruit production versus leaves.
Well, the other thing that happens, yeah, if you fertilize late in the season, you can stimulate late growth, which delays hardiness development and dormancy. And then if we get another Thanksgiving or 1st of December freeze, you've just set the plant up to be much more sensitive to that fall freeze than it would have been otherwise. Hmm.
Well, I'm looking forward to raspberries this year. Some of the ones that we've talked about in the past, I'm always looking forward to my Anne. Now, Anne are the yellow ones.
Mm-hmm.
They come on later.
Mm-hmm. They're a little bit later than, say,
sometimes they
Heritage
don't quite make it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
At least here in my Cache Valley garden. But the flavor is phenomenal.
I love it. It is very good.
And then along with the Caroline that we've talked about in the mm-hmm. past, is humongous berries.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been branching out into some others. What is some of your research
so
showing?
So we've had one that I really like for flavor, and that's a lot earlier than Anne and even earlier than Heritage and kind of in the Caroline window, maybe just a little bit earlier, is Palana. It's got a nice flavor to it.
Is it an everbearer?
Yes, it's okay. a fall bearing. And there's one of its sisters it comes from the same breeding program, and they're closely related, is one called Polka.
I've got that one.
Polka,
love it.
Polka is even earlier than Palana. It's not going to produce big yields, but it comes on quite early and gets done, and you get some nice fruit. And the flavor on it's good, too.
I really liked Polka. And you had some down at Kaysville,
mm-hmm.
and there were still a few berries left. I was down there for a tunnel workshop, and like, wow, which one's this one? Oh, I've got this one.
Yeah,
so I'm looking forward
a good
to
one.
This summer too.
Yeah. And another one that is similar season to Palana that's been a real high yielder for us is Joan Jay. It's got one of the knocks against it. Some of the commercial growers aren't as happy with it as some others because the fruit, by the time it's ripe, tends to be kind of dark. So it almost looks like the berries are overripe, but they're not. They look a little bit... You know, if somebody...
We're just too picky as
consumers. Yeah, exactly. Well, if somebody picked a flat and brought them to you, you'd think, oh, did they pick these last week? No, they're fresh picked. It's just the color of the fruit's a little dark. It's got a nice flavor, and it's very productive. And
it's called Joan Jay.
Joan Jay.
And that's everbearer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So which has been producing well as far as your summer bears?
So Well, Canby still does really well. That's kind of the old garden variety.
I can't find a different berry. It just seems like I lose so many of them with, horntail wasps and cane borers. They just mm-hmm. seem to be more susceptible to that in my garden.
You know, it's that those are problems that are more that all the summer bears in general are more susceptible to those mm-hmm. issues than the fall bears. Partly because you're just cutting them back to the ground. But Canby's a good one. Some of the Pacific Northwest ones, that's kind of a mix. Some of those have done very well. Some of the Cascade series have done pretty well. Some have done terribly.
Is there like Cascade Delight?
Yeah, there's Cascade Dawn and Delight and Bounty. And Delight has done pretty well. We've had problems with, Cowichan's another Pacific Northwest one that's done pretty well. It's very vigorous. The canes grow huge. And you do get a little bit of winter dieback. but they still are quite productive. We've had some issues. Toulamine is kind of the flavor standard, and it's not hardy to anywhere other than maybe the Southern Wasatch Front and maybe Dixie, because it we get a lot of cane dieback with toulamine. So I wouldn't recommend that. And there's some others, Willamette and some of those that are in that same category that just aren't really hardy enough to withstand our conditions.
Okay. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Brent Black, USU Extension Fruit Specialist, has been my guest. And coming up next is a Petals and Prose segment, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that and then be back with us next Thursday morning at 10 o'clock.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. I do so like to receive indications from listeners, questions or ideas or thoughts about what I might have talked about. And since for the last two times I've been able to do Petals and Prose, when I was talking about orchids, I received a couple of letters from listeners. The first is from a very dear friend of mine, Star Colebrook, and I had given her an orchid, and she writes, "The orchid and I are at the kitchen table, 5 a.m., feeling delicate and elegant together, though I'm in my nightgown and jacket with a hot pack on my neck. The orchid's magenta, maroon on white is one of those occurrences in nature that there are no words for, not splotches, not spots. The colors occur like ink stains, but not quite. And the purpley red also has hints of orange, especially on the little bent fangs at the ends of the jaw, with deeper maroon in the fuzzy tongue at the very back of the mouth. Well, I'm one of those poets Robert Bly disparages in his News of the Universe collection. He doesn't like poets who make wild nature into human likenesses. But it goes both ways, I think. Humans are wild in nature, and orchids are both wild and domesticated. I love thinking about the attributes we share." And she goes on to say, she remembers my having read from Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief, and remembers her list of orchids, among them ladies' tresses. "My Mitch and I went in search of ladies' tresses last summer in a Mendon pasture with Brian Dixon and the Nature Conservancy to mark each flowering stem with orange stakes and record their location on GPS to keep them off the federal endangered list and protect them locally as local treasures. We were pursuing beautiful things in a not-so-terrible place, which could become one of those terrible places if not for people like Brian. The ladies' tresses could be equated with Orlean's ghost orchids if not for the want of those who love orchids enough to protect them. And I would have been like Orlean, forever wanting to see them, but only if I'd known of them and had not gone looking. Just knowing they are there is a gift. As she says, it's lovely to have one thing you will always want to see. There's value in that as well, because you can imagine they, or it, will always be there, never be lost." And the matter of common names as contrasted with Latin names arises here. Common names are troublesome because they aren't the same everywhere. And so the Latin names for flowers is helpful and most accurate. And that comes to play in a letter from a friend of mine in Guatemala. She actually had not heard the program on orchids, but she happened to write me about them. And she says that she went to a large local nursery and saw a gorgeous orchid there. "I asked after an attendant for the name of it, and he told me it was called terrestrial orchid. I said, yes, I can see it's growing in soil and not on a tree, but what is its name?" He looked at me as though I had two heads and said he would ask. The person he asked told me in English, "Its name is Chinese ground orchid." I told him the plant had to belong to a specific orchid family and had to have a Latin name. He said he would look it up on the internet. That, of course, would be fantastic. She says that sarcastically because she doesn't use the internet, and she wanted him to know the Latin name. Well, I'm moving from thoughts of orchids. Well, not actually. I bought one for myself today, but I'm wanting to talk today about winter gardens. And this first quotation is from Elizabeth Lawrence. And if you have listened to my Petals and Prose all along, I did talk about a letter exchange between Elizabeth Lawrence and Catherine White of the New Yorker, and also the wife of E.B. White. And their correspondence was lengthy and long and wonderful, usually about flowers. And it has been published and is extremely interesting to read. So this is from Elizabeth Lawrence, who lived in North Carolina. Of course, Catherine White lived in the East, and they never met, but they wrote. So this is Elizabeth Lawrence. I never did care for fair weather gardeners. Standing behind glass doors and looking out at the cold ground and leafless branches, they exclaim, "How beautiful this must be in spring." Well, how beautiful it is now, I want to cry. If a lavender wash were laid on the boles of pine trees and the pale trunks of oriental magnolias, on the purple bricks around the pool, the red earth, the amber gravel, the fawn-colored stone, drawing them all together in a series of related tones. How beautiful it is when the pattern of the garden becomes clear again, wherein no leaves blur the long straight line or gentle curve or the restful circle laid on the square, when levels are sharply defined and intervals between steps have the rhythm of falling water, when hidden nests are revealed, distant treetops unveiled, and lost vistas regained. Sweeter yet than dream of song of summer or spring or winter's sometimes smiles. The season's beauty is in the quality of the sunlight, which is more luminous when it is less brilliant, and in the delicacy of shadows, which are paler and more precise across gravel walks. My garden seems more beautiful than at any other time. The essence of warmth and light is in this delicious sun that seeps into the spirit and penetrates the marrow. At no other season is the sun so grateful, so gentle, and so healing. And then she goes on to say later, talking about British gardens, in Great Britain, people have always wanted to be out of doors, whether the weather is fine or not fine, and they have planted for all seasons. For his winter walks, Bacon, like formal alleys of evergreens, finely graveled and no grass because of the wet. Wordsworth's garden was a sheltered spot surrounded by informal groups of trees and shrubs, chosen for their attractiveness in winter. And in all seasons, Jane Austen's heroines wandered in the shrubbery. When I read about English gardens of the past, I think of their owners as still in them, seeking out an out-of-season primrose, watching for the first snowdrop. I think of Miss Jekyll at Munstead Wood, clumping along in her heavy boots. And some of you may remember my having talked about Gertrude Jekyll, the famous landscape architect in England. But the mention of Wordsworth's garden, I remembered some quite famous words of Wordsworth about gardens. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. And I looked back at Catherine White's writing, found a note she had written when she talked about one of her pleasures for winter gardens is winter reading and winter daydreams of what might be. The gardens of the mind are as rewarding a part of gardening as the partial successes of a good summer bloom. A lot of us don't have enough land, perhaps, to think of patterns and extensions, but even in a very small garden, to think beyond just putting in some petunias without thinking of form and the arrangement probably gives us less of beauty than we might have. Another book that I've enjoyed reading in is called The Morville Hours by Catherine Swift, and she too considers winter gardens. She says, I still love the garden best in monochrome, in snow, in moonlight, in frost, in heavy dew, in fog, especially in freezing fog, when whole trees are drowned fathoms deep in Arctic air and the boundaries between sky and ground blur, when the silvered paths of the garden seem to float over the black earth of the empty beds like slender bridges, cantilevered over a chasm, and twigs and branches are transformed by the hoarfrost into fragile constructions of ice and air, each day a little longer, growing in the direction in which the air is flowing, like finger posts to the far north. My garden was conceived in winter, a garden of ruler straight lines and precise measurements of black ink and white paper, moonlight and shadows, the plan of a city which did not exist, a map of a place not yet discovered. The last book about winter pleasures talks about something that I like to do in late winter or early spring, and that is forcing branches into bloom so that I can bring them in the house and have spring a little earlier than it would be outside. This is from Our Life in Gardens by Joe Eck and Wayne Winterwood, and they say, in the middle of January, almost always, there comes a brief period of mild days so predictable from year to year that it has a name like any other season, the January thaw. Those days are a tease, really, for the cruelty of February still lies before us, and even March can go out like the lion it came in as. But for the few days, rain might fall, snows melt, and every night temperatures hover around 20. Here in Vermont, January thaw does not hurry winter along, for we must still be enthralled to it for 2 or even 3 months. They go on to talk about this, but I'll tell you briefly what I do when I force branches. Pussy willows, all of the willows are easy to force. Forsythia works well. And essentially, I just cut back the bark a little bit, an inch and a half or two, put them in warm water in a dark place for about a week, and then bring them into the sun, and they will go into blossom. So when you're bone weary of winter and can't wait for spring, this is the time to force such spring blossoms into bloom. When you force branches into bloom about a month or two before they would bloom normally, you enjoy spring ahead of time. So bundle up, go out in the yard, and cut some branches from your dormant flowering shrubs and trees. I hope that you might have the pleasure of doing this. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earl. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.